headlines, the Palestinian Authority has warned that Israel's daily assaults against Palestinians could destabilize the whole region. Beijing is calling on Washington to stop turning Taiwan into a powder keg, urging the U.S. to respect the One China principle. Also in our headlines, Russia promises concrete actions in response to a recent attack on the Kremlin, which it blames on Ukraine and the U.S. Hello and welcome everybody here in Iranian capital Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the Palestinian Authority has warned that Israel's daily assaults against Palestinians will destabilize the region and make things spiral out of control. The Palestinian Authority held the regime responsible for any escalation of violence across the Palestinian territories. It called on Israel's staunchest ally, the U.S., to push the regime into ending its crimes against Palestinians. On Thursday, the regime's forces killed a Palestinian woman near the city of Nablus over an alleged knife attack against Israelis. Hours earlier, they raided a Nablus neighborhood, killing three Palestinian men. Israel accused them of being behind an April attack that left two Israelis dead. Palestinians say their operations against Israelis are a natural response to the regime's atrocities. Iran and Syria have issued a joint statement at the end of President Ebrahim Raisi's historic visit to the Arab country that took place on Wednesday and Thursday. The two sides have pledged to continue their strategic cooperation in all fields, particularly in economy and trade. They've also agreed to continue combating terrorism until all terror groups are eliminated.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi on Thursday wrapped up his two-day visit to Syria, where he met with his counterpart Bashar al-Assad. The visit was the first by an Iranian president to Syria since the Arab country was gripped by war in 2011. Raisi has called his Syria visit a turning point in bilateral ties.
This trip will be a turning point in Iran-Syria relations and will have an effect on the region and the trade and economic relations of the two countries.
The Iranian and Syrian governments have also issued a joint statement that highlights several points. The two sides have expressed strong determination to cement bilateral relations in different areas, particularly trade and economy. On Wednesday, the first day of his trip, the Iranian president signed a long-term comprehensive strategic cooperation agreement with his Syrian counterpart at the presidential palace in Damascus. Raisi said the long-term agreement will open a new chapter in cordial relations. 14 more documents were signed as well, all aiming to enhance bilateral cooperation. Iran, meanwhile, renewed its readiness to help Syria in its reconstruction efforts following the years-long conflict triggered by foreign-backed militancy. The pledge was made by President Raisi as he made a speech at the Holy Shrine of Hazrat Zainab, the granddaughter of Prophet Muhammad. Raisi also lashed out at the U.S. and Israel for backing terror groups in Syria.
For 12 years, the oppressed people hatched conspiracies and committed sedition, gave easy money to Daesh and Takfiri terrorist groups, used media empires to conduct psychological warfare, inflicted damage, destroyed homes, killed children, and made women homeless. For 12 years, the U.S., Israel, and the Takfiri Daesh terrorist groups they backed committed crimes in Syria. But Syria is standing strong today.
Combating terrorism is another issue Iran and Syria put focus on in their joint statement. They've pledged to continue to work together to fight terrorism and extremism until all terror groups are completely wiped out. The statement also denounces the U.S. military presence in Syria as well as its looting of the country's natural resources. It demands the international community to bring an end to the U.S. measures. The Iranian-Syrian statement also denounces Western sanctions imposed on both nations. Meanwhile, it slammed the Israeli regime for its repeated acts of aggression against Syria, saying that Damascus has the right to respond to Tel Aviv's aggression. The statement said that the Israeli aggression is a destabilizing factor in West Asia. Iran has said President Raisi's visit to Syria is in line with efforts to reinforce the axis of resistance in West Asia, including in the occupied territories, Lebanon, and Syria itself. This should be seen against the backdrop of Israel's weakening position in the region, as the regime is gripped by turmoil inside and facing mounting resistance outside. Iran and Syria are both under Western economic sanctions. The restrictive measures, however, seem to be a blessing in disguise for both nations as they're resolute in overcoming economic hurdles by forming stronger bonds and relying on their own potentialities.
Historian and journalist Brett Yonker says that the Iranian president's visit to Syria sends the messages that how things are normalized and stabilized in the Arab country following the years-long war there.
You look at how much destroyed and occupied it was in the past decade. We're talking about there has been no visit by an Iranian president to Syria since 2011. And of course, this is for the simple reason that, especially since 2012, Syria was subjected to the fiercest and most brutal aggression that imaginable. This is aggression, of course, by a coalition of imperialist states in the West, by Zionist-backed terrorists, and by various groups of Wahhabi Takfiri. So when a country like that, at a certain point in the past 10 years, looked like it was almost ready to collapse, and still pulled itself together, fought off all invaders and all occupiers, and now has been, for the most part, not entirely yet, unfortunately, but for the most part, liberated, and can now not just create new relations and new bonds with friendly nations, but also receive the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran within Damascus and go on all these, to sign on all these memoranda, all these agreements, and go to all these meetings and these gatherings. That shows that the normalization of the situation in Syria is definitely has come to a great extent. And it's not just Iran, of course, who has been meeting with Syrian officials, but even countries that Syria in the past was on almost hostile footing with have now had to accept that Syria will stand, that the Syrian Arab Republic has been victorious. So this is when even the Emiratis and the Saudis and the Turks, they have had to accept the fact that Syria isn't going anywhere. And I think this meeting with Syed Ibrahim Raisi in Damascus really shows to the world that the Syrian Arab Republic is here to stay. It is a stable government. It's a stable state that has fended off all aggression that has tried to topple it.
China has warned that the United States is turning Taiwan into a powder keg after the U.S. participation in a Taipei event aimed to discuss military cooperation last week.
U.S. arms sales to Taiwan seriously violates the One China principle and the three China-U.S. joint communiques, especially the August 17 communique. China always firmly opposes such sales. Lately, the U.S. and Taiwan have been continuously strengthening military collusion. Visit of 25 U.S. arms dealers to Taiwan and the so-called Defense Forum held by the Democratic Progressive Party authorities once again reveals the fact that the U.S. is turning Taiwan into a powder keg. And it's the Taiwan compatriots who will suffer from this.
The spokeswoman made the remarks in response to the presence and remarks of former U.S. Marine Corps Force Commander Stephen Rutter at the forum. Mao also urged Washington to stop its military ties with the self-ruled island and refrain from igniting tensions in the Taiwan Strait. She vowed that Beijing will take firm measures to safeguard its national sovereignty and security interests. In recent months, tensions between China and the U.S. has risen over Washington's growing military and political support for Taiwan. Beijing regards the island as its own territory. Under the One China principle, China often conducts military drills around the island as a warning to Taiwan's separatist forces and their collusion with external powers. Well, joining us now from Hong Kong, we have Independent China Specialist Andrew Loing. Sir, welcome to the program. What do you make of China's recent warning to the U.S.?
Well, this is, the warning has been going on for quite some time, especially in advance of Nancy Pelosi's visit and thereafter. But then the United States and its Western allies seem to be focused on painting China into a corner because China is now seen as an existential threat to American hegemony. But on the other hand, very few of their leaders truly understand what China is all about. I mean, China is not going to rule the world. It's got no ambitions of doing so. What China wants is just to grow their own economy and improve the lives of the Chinese people. However, as far as Taiwan is concerned, of course, Taiwan has been part of China for a long, long time. Of course, this is China's red line. The fact remains that most Taiwanese people, they don't want to go to war with Beijing. What they want, most of them want, is just to preserve the status quo. Unfortunately, the United States is trying to hollow out the one China, so-called one China policy by creating more and more space for Taiwan to play, as if Taiwan was a separate country. And also arming Taiwan to the teeth, turning Taiwan into a military porcupine. And now, this latest situation where the American armed dealers are visiting Taiwan to sell more guns to Taiwanese people. Now, I must say that I don't think that Taiwanese people would necessarily want to follow American example of owning guns, and each person owns a gun, because that's not part of Chinese characteristics, whether they are Chinese on the mainland or Chinese on Taiwan or Chinese in Hong Kong, for example. So I think that this the latest visit of the American armed dealers seems again betrays a total lack of understanding of China's civilization and China's culture. But then it also reflects the kind of very complex psychology mantra painting China, painting Beijing as the existential threat. When you look at it, I mean, China's not going to send its army to conquer other countries. China's not, even though China's strengthening its military over the Taiwan Straits, that's just to prevent Taiwan from declaring independence or preparing other countries trying to promote Taiwan's independence. As for the patrols in the China's navy, this again because of the South China Sea and the at the Pacific, is China's lifeblood, is the sea lane of communication for China's essential lifeblood of trade, international trade, and importation of essential commodities. And these sea lanes of communication are being encircled by America's first island chain centered in Okinawa, second island chain centered in Guam, and then, of course, added to the Singapore Malacca Strait choke point. So if you were in China, you would feel threatened, and you would not necessarily build your own navy. But all these defensive actions are now being painted by the West as China's aggression. So again, this situation with this visit of the armed dealers to Taiwan, again, betrays a total lack of understanding in the West. So unfortunately, this feeds into increasing American rhetoric, increasing American bellicosity towards China. It's not good for the United States, not good for China, not good for the rest of the world.
All right, that was a very comprehensive answer. We're going to leave it there. Independent China Specialist Andrew Loing joining us from Hong Kong. Elsewhere, early results from the Thursday local elections in England are coming. The ruling Conservatives are suffering losses while the main opposition Labour Party is gaining more seats. Based on the early results, the Conservatives have so far lost 218 seats on local councils. That's while the Labour has added 118 seats, making it confident that it will win the 2024 general elections. The Liberal Democrats and the Green Party have made gains as well. Final results are expected later today. They will decide more than 8,000 council seats in 230 local government authorities. The losses are the UK Conservatives, come despite efforts by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to restore the credibility of his party. The Conservatives have been facing public discontent over a range of issues, from political scandals to a worsening cost of living crisis. Moscow has again accused the United States of cooperating in a Wednesday drone attack, which Russian officials say aimed to kill President Vladimir Putin.
If you believe that as soon as the United States and Ukraine rejected the accusations, we should stop thinking what we know about. This is not the case, and the ability of our Ukrainian and Western friends to lie is very well known.
Lavrov blamed the attack on what he called a terrorist from Ukraine. He said it's impossible for them to carry out the attack without the knowledge of their minders. Lavrov also said Russia will respond with concrete actions. Both Ukraine and the U.S. have denied any involvement in the attack that hit the Kremlin. The incident comes as tensions already run high between Russia and the U.S. over the war in Ukraine. Moscow is accusing Washington of fueling the conflict by giving arms to Kiev.
Russia has accused Ukraine of attacking the Kremlin with drones in a failed assassination to kill President Vladimir Putin, vowing retaliation for what it has called a terrorist attack. Moscow has said the two drones were used in the alleged attack on Putin's residence in the Kremlin's citadel overnight, adding that the drones were disabled by electronic defenses.
It is technically possible. Ukraine has several types of drones that can fit the profile. For example, its newly developed UJ-22 drone can actually fly the distance. It's a commercial drone that they acquired from China. It's Mugen 5 cargo drone, which can be basically purchased online and could be refitted into a military drone. That drone can fly several hundred kilometers, and it was used in previous attacks.
Kremlin statement said, "We regard these actions as a planned terrorist act and an attempt on the president's life carried out on the eve of Victory Day, the May 9 parade, at which the presence of foreign guests is also planned."
And of course, attacks of this kind, if they are in fact carried by Ukrainian military, are meant to keep the Russian military off balance by forcing them to reallocate and rededicate air defense resources to specific places like Moscow, probably at the expense of other regions, including, for example, Russian military inside Ukraine proper that has to have enough air defense and electronic warfare protection.
Separately, the Speaker of Russia's parliament demanded the use of, quote, weapons capable of stopping and destroying the Kiev terrorist regime, response to the alleged attack on Kremlin. However, Ukraine denied any involvement in the alleged drone operation. Kiev has said the attack was, quote, staged by Moscow.
The Russians may try to leverage this narrative around an assassination on Putin to then up their game with regards to pretext to go after Zelensky himself. But they've been trying to do that anyway since the beginning of the war. There's plenty of reporting that indicates Russian kind of kill teams were out there trying to hunt down both Zelensky and his family. So it's mainly, I think, a rally around the flag effect that the Russians are going for.
Meanwhile, Ukraine says Russia has targeted cities in a new wave of missile strikes and shelling across the country. Officials and media outlets say multiple explosions were heard in the capital, Kiev, and elsewhere. Blasts caused by Russian shelling were also reported in the southern Zaporizhzhia region and the port city of Odessa. Kiev and some central and eastern Ukrainian regions have announced air alerts following the Russian statement accusing Ukraine of attacking the Kremlin. There are now some reports that Ukrainian forces have begun their counterattack in Bakhmut.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Stature. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the Home Office plans to house asylum seekers in 10 unused cruise ships, ferries and barges in ports around the country. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The Home Office is planning to use 10 redundant cruise ships, ferries and barges to house asylum seekers in ports around the country, with Liverpool expected to be next in line as ministers struggle to get to grips with the asylum backlog. Officials have been told to look at all options to find housing for people caught up in processing delays, including former military camps and prisons. With the total backlog more than 1,500 higher than in December, when Prime Minister Rishi Sunak pledged to clear it within a year. Home Office insiders have conceded that they may have to find more hotels to house people, despite pressure from Conservative backbench MPs after failing to locate 10,000 spaces in military camps, disused prisons and large vessels as hoped. The Guardian has been told that one leading maritime company is even conducting a feasibility study into housing migrants on redundant oil rigs, an idea that ministers rejected back in 2020 as a no-go because of enormous logistical and safety difficulties, and the Home Office is unlikely to adopt. The revelation that the government wants as many as 10 vessels at a cost of millions of pounds to the taxpayer comes after ministers confirmed plans to house about 400 people in a giant barge in Dorset, as they try to allay concerns from backbench Conservative MPs over the use of hotels in their constituencies. The barge, Bibby Stockholm, will be berthed in Portland Port from early June. The first group of migrants expected to be single men nearing the end of their asylum processing claims are expected to board the barge later that month, with more people arriving over the summer. Whitehall sources said that Suella Braverman, the Home Secretary, was also close to confirming a deal for a 1,800-capacity former cruise ship to house migrants that would be berthed in the Mersey, although no contract has yet been signed. Peel Ports, which owns and operates port infrastructure in the Birkenhead area, has said it would only go ahead with the plans if there was full engagement with the local council. Local politicians, however, have condemned the proposal, pointing to a lack of infrastructure and describing the plans as a floating prison. Ministers are reported to be plotting to force Prime Minister Sunak's illegal migration bill into law if it is blocked or watered down by the House of Lords this summer, with plans to use the Parliament Act to overrule peers to force the legislation onto the statute book. Nevertheless, the rarely used device is unlikely to succeed before the next general election, as the government must wait 12 months after a law is rejected by the House of Lords. Instead, ministers who are keen to sound tough on small boat crossings before this week's local elections are expected to blame peers for their failure to deliver. The search for suitable vessels to house asylum seekers and the logistics of where to berth them are believed to have hindered the Home Office's attempts to clear the asylum backlog, with hundreds of migrants still arriving across the Channel every week. Home Office sources said they did not have a target for the number of vessels that they planned to use. Industry insiders said there was a shortage of barges available on market, with many in use for offshore construction projects, and some other governments also said to be interested in acquiring them to house migrants. Ministers had initially planned to use disused cruise ships and ferries, as they were able to accommodate more people. The Guardian has reported that possible vessels included a former cruise ship from Indonesia. Few ports in the United Kingdom are big enough to accommodate them. The Guardian has been told that officials have been asked to find another 10,000 places not in hotels for the end of this year, but so far just 5,400 places are expected to be ready to receive migrants by the end of this year. They include accommodation at the former military bases at Wethersfield and Scampton, which would hold 3,700 people, and reopening of immigration detention centres in Haslar in Hampshire and Campsfield near Oxford, which would hold 1,000. A further 1,200 people could be accommodated at North Eye, a former prison in East Sussex, and at barracks in Catterick, in Rishi Sunak's North Yorkshire constituency, while 400 people would be placed under barge in Portland, Dorset. One government source said the use of giant barges or refurbished ferries and cruise ships to house refugees could have a deterrent effect on people arriving in small boats across the channel, although critics suggest it would amount to arbitrary detention. The website youractive.com has also covered this story and tells us more. The Home Office plans to house asylum seekers in 10 unused cruise ships, ferries and barges in ports around the country. Officials have been told to look at all options to find housing for asylum seekers dealing with processing delays. This includes former military camps and even prisons. In December, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said the government expected to abolish the backlog of initial asylum decisions by the end of next year. This means the Home Office would need to make nearly 25,000 decisions a quarter to meet this promise. The Home Office is also launching a 3-day hackathon in May to search for quicker ways to reduce the asylum backlog. The Home Office also plans to use artificial intelligence to process the 138,052 undecided asylum cases. The United Kingdom has also been working on an illegal migration bill, which would enable the detention of unlawful arrivals without bail or judicial review within the first 28 days of detention until they can be removed. It includes provisions to prevent asylum seekers from claiming to be a victim of modern-day slavery to avoid or delay their removal. On 27th of March this year, in a letter addressed to both chambers of Britain's Parliament, the Council of Europe's Commissioner for Human Rights, Dunja Mijatovic, urged lawmakers to vote against the bill. The regional newspaper, the Liverpool Echo, has also covered this story. The government is considering housing as many as 1,800 asylum seekers on a vessel moored off the Wirral, the Liverpool Echo understands. Local politicians and charities have raised concerns about the plans, which would form part of the government's highly controversial new policy for placing newly arrived migrants on barges, cruise ships, disused ferries and military bases, and other vessels that have been described by some as floating prisons. The Liverpool Echo understands that any such boat could be moored on water in Birkenhead, close to Wirral Waters, which is a £4.5 billion waterfront development currently being built by the Peel Group. Peel Ports owns and operates the waters and port infrastructure in the Birkenhead area and says it will only go ahead with the plans with full engagement with the local authority. The government has not directly confirmed the Wirral plan, but says it is looking at moving asylum seekers out of hotels and onto barges and ferries in a bid to cut down on costs. Charities say that if applications for asylum were being properly processed, then no such measures would be required. Speaking about the potential Wirral plans, Wallasey MP Angela Eagle said, "I think this policy is an admission of failure. If the government was doing its day job properly and processing asylum applications properly, then we would not be in this position." Wirral Waters is a huge regeneration project. It doesn't have transport links to local services. So these people would be sort of on what effectively resembles a floating prison without any links to those services. There has been no advanced consultation with local leaders. The way they are handling this just reeks of incompetence. Hotels in the Wallasey and Hoy Lake area of Wirral are currently being used to house asylum seekers. It is not clear if the plan would be to move those currently based in those hotels onto a vessel in the water off the peninsula. Claire Mosley is the founder of the National Care for Calais charity, who also lives in Wirral. Claire Mosley says, "It has been encouraging and heartwarming to see the response of the local community to asylum seekers in Wallasey and Hoy Lake. We know the Wirral is a tolerant and welcoming place. However, placing a high number of people in confined housing on our shores will place a strain on the local community and on local services. This type of accommodation does not give asylum seekers access to the community's support that they really need."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
The topic that I have chosen, as I had mentioned last night, was to talk about some of the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen, to understand what does it mean to be the Shia of Ali. We cannot become like Ali, just as we cannot become like Hussein. But in Ziyarat al-Warisa, we address the Ashab of Hussein and we say, فَيَا لَيْتَنِي كُنْتُ مَعَكُمْ فَعَفُوزُ فَوْزًا عَظِيمًا. That we say to the companions of Hussein, that I wish I was there to attain that same status as you have attained. So we can say to the Ashab of Ali that we cannot become like Ali, but we will try to become like the companions of Ali. And last night we started with the example of Salman al-Farsi. There's quite a lot to say about him. And even tonight I would not be able to complete. One of the important contributions of Salman was his idea and suggestion to the Prophet about digging the ditch, the trench around the strategic area in Medina, so that when the allied forces Al-Ahzab. You know this surah in Quran, surah number 33? It's known as Al-Ahzab. Means the allied forces. I'm using the modern term. The mushrikeen of Mecca and various tribes affiliated to them, and the Jewish tribes around Medina. They're all combined together for a final battle against Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And that's why it's known as Al-Ahzab. Both groups got together. And in that battle, it's there that, you know, the Prophet used these words for Salman, because when every group was assigned to dig the ditch, you know, Ansar said, "Where is Salman minna?" Muhajirin said, "No, Salman minna. He's from us." And Rasulullah said, "He's not from Ansar, not from Muhajirin. Salman minna Ahlul Bayt." And this is a unique honor given to a Sahabi to know any other Sahabi. Going to suffer because of it. Salawat. It was not only his words, even in his actions and his lifestyle, Salman tried to live the example of Ali. You know, Amir al-Mu'mineen, especially when he became the Khalifa, his lifestyle became very simple. It's not that he didn't have anything to eat or didn't have money at that time. He had. He was an affluent person by that time. But he decided that I am the Khalifa of Muslimin, and I would like to live a lifestyle where even the most poor person would be able to relate to me. So it was by choice. His poverty was by choice. And he wanted his governors actually to also be in the same way. If you look at Salman of course was not the governor during his time. He was a governor in the previous administration, actually during the time of Umar, by the permission of Ali, of course. For the sake of the general good of the Muslims, Amir al-Mu'mineen cooperated with the government on certain issues. And one of them was this issue of Salman becoming governor of Madain. There also, if you look at his lifestyle, very similar to Amir al-Mu'mineen. Even his food was very simple. You know, bread and salt, nothing else. Whatever he would get, his share from Baitul Mal, he will give it away to the poor and the needy. Amir al-Mu'mineen, in a letter to Usman bin Hunayf, his governor in Basra, when he found out that this person went to a very, you know, big, you know, grand party organized by some rich people, only the affluent and rich were there, Amir al-Mu'mineen wrote a letter to him saying, you know, "What are you doing? You're my governor." And then he says something very interesting. He says, I don't expect you to become like me. I know you, even though you are my governor, I know you cannot live a life like me. But at least try that. Try to get closer to me." And this is what I would say. The lesson that we can take from Salman is that, you know, we cannot become like Ali. Probably we cannot even reach to the level of Salman. But at least we can always look and see what we eat, what we drink. Is it from the halal sustenance? Is it coming from the halal source? And in that, we will be able to, you know, try to follow those footsteps of Salman and get closer and closer to Ali bin Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam. I wanted to go back to this issue of, you know, the gradings of the levels of Iman and the steps of Iman that I mentioned yesterday as the basis of my discussion. That we should realize that our life is the life of constant struggle to reach to the higher levels of Iman. And there is no end to that. We have to do that constantly till the last moment of our life. We cannot say, "Alhamdulillah, I have reached to this level." Because whatever I think, there would be a level above it. Every khair that you do, there is something even more that you can do. Except one, and that is shahadat. After shahadat, you can't do anything. Iman has levels. Salman is on the 10th level, Abu Zar on the 9th, Miqdad on the 8th. Amir al-Mu'minin is not on a level, he's a symbol himself. He's the condition for iman of individuals. Now let me go to another aspect of this concept. I just want to make this concept very clear before we move on. Interaction between iman and amal salih. When you reach to a higher level, suppose you are on level 1 of iman, and you try to work hard, your amal becomes better, your iman elevates, goes up. When your iman goes up, the value of your amal increases, your good deed. And when you improve on that, even the iman becomes better. So there is an interaction between iman and amal. This true faith and good deed. If the level of iman goes up, the quality of your good deed will go up. When the quality of good deeds go up, your level of iman will also go up. And this goes continuously. And this is where you have to realize that when you talk about the good deeds of a person, the value of a good deed depends on the iman of the person. You know, we have this whole debate, especially when they talk about religious pluralism, that, oh, we just look at the good deed. He's a good person, that's it. Iman is not that important. From our perspective, yes, we are human beings. We judge one another only on the basis of their actions, because we don't have the ability to know what is inside their heart. But don't expect the same standard and measure that Allah will be using. He has no limitations. And Quran is very clear about it. And that is why I'm using the ayat of Quran here, 6 of them, that where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that complete and true faith is a prerequisite for the acceptance of good deeds. Good deeds by themselves have no value. It depends on the true iman and the niyyat of an individual.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
According to World Trade Organization, global food prices are likely to soar higher in 2023. According to the organization, costs shot up by nearly 20% last year. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT reported food prices surged 18% globally last year, including a 21% rise in the cost of grain. The World Trade Organization, WTO, estimated in its global trade outlook published recently. According to the organization, fertilizer prices saw an even larger increase of 63% year-on-year. The WTO noted that, in theory, higher food costs should encourage more agricultural production, resulting in greater availability and lower prices for food in the future, but warned that move expensive fertilizers could lead to reduced crop yields and ultimately new price spikes. The organization also noted that food prices fluctuated strongly in 2022, first jumping 19% between January and May, following the start of Russia's special operation in Ukraine, and then dropping 15% between May and December. Overall, while global food supplies are less precarious than many had feared in connection with the Russia-Ukraine crisis, they remain a cause for concern, WTO warned. According to its calculations, the volume of world wheat trade, for instance, fell roughly 7.5% since 2021, which leaves little margin for error if a major producer suffers a crop failure or climate-related natural disaster. WTO Director General Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala recently called on developed economies to be vigilant to signs of the food crisis triggering hunger in poorer nations. She reiterated her earlier calls for lifting export restrictions on food and fertilizers, noting that as of April 2023, some 67 countries have such curbs. She also warned that global trade is likely to remain under pressure from external factors in 2023. According to her, these include the crisis in Ukraine and other geopolitical tensions, inflation, and the impact of tightening monetary policy. She concluded, this makes it even more important for governments to avoid trade fragmentation and refrain from introducing obstacles to trade. Investing in multilateral cooperation on trade would bolster economic growth and people's living standards over the long term. According to Reuters, shoppers around the world will have to pay even more for groceries this year than they did in 2022. Reuters reported recently, citing retailers, consumer goods firms, and investors. The report indicated that tough price negotiations have been unfolding between retailers and consumer goods producers for more than a year now, with friction beginning in 2021 over COVID-related supply chain logjams. The situation worsened in 2022 as the skyrocketing prices of basic foodstuffs have exacerbated a cost of living crisis in the EU and the UK. Data by research firm Kantar shows that Britons paid a record 16.7% more for food in the 4 weeks up to January 22 this year, compared to the same period last year. Meanwhile, the U.S. Food Index, which includes meals eaten at home and in cafes and restaurants, jumped 10.4% for the year ending in December. Food giant Nestlé CEO Mark Schindler told media outlets last week that the company would have to hike the prices of its food products further this year in 2023 to offset higher production costs that it has yet to fully pass on to consumers. Another leading manufacturer of consumer goods, Unilever, is also expected to increase prices for some products in 2023. Portfolio manager of Waverton Investment Management, Tinke Frike, said the last time we heard from Unilever, it was made clear that they prefer to sell fewer products at higher prices to keep prices below peers and gain market share. The world's biggest retailer, Walmart, warned in December that some packaged goods suppliers are still pointing us towards more inflation next year, on top of the mid-double digits this year. According to Bernstein analyst Bruno Montien, consumer goods manufacturers will continue to raise prices until they recover their profitability. He explained to Reuters, the only thing that can stop this is consumers starting to trade down to private label products at a more rapid pace. And if commodities keep declining, then there may be no need for more price increases.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei in a meeting with Iranian officials and the ambassadors of Islamic countries on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr on April 22, 2023. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. All praises due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. I would like to congratulate all the respected people here in this meeting, including the heads of Iran's executive branches, our officials, and the ambassadors and representatives of Islamic countries on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr. I would also like to congratulate the entire Iranian nation, who are truly deserving of congratulations because of their behaviour and their meritorious deeds during the month of Ramadan. I would also like to extend my congratulations to all of the Muslims in the world and the entire Islamic nation. I hope that the Almighty God will bless everyone during this Eid. The month of Ramadan provides the environment for hearts to become closer to each other.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
All of the various dimensions of the month of Ramadan help to bring the hearts of people closer to each other, both within the country and within the entire Islamic Ummah. First of all, the tenderness that is created in people by their fasting, prayers, supplications, and recitation of the Quran is itself a source for bringing the hearts closer together. And piety brings hearts together, just as the President pointed out in his statements. He stated this very well when he said that the secret to fasting is piety. In my opinion, the officials of Islamic countries should use this opportunity to increase unity and closeness among the members of the Islamic nation. Our problem today is division. Even though the Quran prohibits division, do not be like those who became divided into sects and differed. The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verse 105. And it commands us to be united. وَاعْتَصِمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ جَمِيعًا وَلَا تَفَرَّقُوا. Hold fast altogether to Allah's rope and do not be divided. The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verse 103. The members of the Islamic nation, the Islamic Ummah, are divided. Yes, there are different opinions, there are different sects, and there are different tastes. That's fine. But these different tastes do not mean that we should be deprived of the great blessings of the Islamic nation being united.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.